Support for this podcast comes from Planned Parenthood. It's hard to imagine a world where we leave future generations with fewer rights and freedoms. Since the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills aimed at blocking people from getting the essential sexual and reproductive care they need, including abortion. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves access to care. And with supporters like you, they can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future to learn more and support their cause.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
My guest today is Congressman Scott Peters, represents the San Diego area in Congress. He has a bill that is on a subject that is near and dear to my heart, and is the intersection between housing and transit policy. So, this is probably like not the top thing on the actual congressional agenda, but it really should be. In a better world, it would be. So we get to really sort of go deep on this topic. It's a passion project of his too, and I think Weeds fans are really going to love this. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias. My guest today, Representative Scott Peters from the 52nd Congressional District in California, is the first member of Congress to be on the show. So thank you so much for being here with
us. Wow, that's quite an honor. Thank you, Matthew.
There you go. It's a premiere. Hopefully someday we'll have hundreds. So you are the author of the Build More Housing Near Transit Act, which is what we're here to talk about. And I want to commend you for having a bill with a name that conveys actual meaning instead of a cute acronym.
It's a terrible acronym.
But so the idea here, I would take it, is to build more housing.
Near transit,
right. Yes. What does it do? What does the law say?
Well, so basically, so here, let me tell you the story of how I came to this idea.
Yeah.
I was in local government for a while. I was the city council president and at one time representative to our planning organization. We wanted to extend a half-cent sales tax that we imposed countywide to support transportation. And, you know, certainly at that time, wasn't just transit, but one of the big projects we wanted to do is to extend our existing light rail system from downtown, which is the second biggest job center in San Diego County, to an area called University Town Center, which is the biggest job center.
So this is San Diego. Sorry.
San Diego.
People who don't know,
they're
California.
San Diego,
California.
Right, sorry about that. Yeah. And we did extend it. And through the half-cent sales tax, we've generated $1 billion. To contribute to a project. The other $1 billion came from the federal government through a program called New Starts, which is administered by the Federal Transportation Authority. It's supposed to be a competitive grant project where you bring local money to match federal money. And what I realized after I came to Congress is that, you know, no one ever asked us what we were going to build next to this trolley line.
Uh-huh.
We call it the trolley, light rail line. And it seemed to me that that would be a good question for a couple reasons. One is, if you are a taxpayer just concerned about, you know, getting good leverage out of federal money, wouldn't you want to know that there were things that people would use the trolley to get back and forth from, origins and destinations, particularly homes? And then second, if you're an environmentalist and you really want to you want to think that public transportation is going to get people out of their cars, you're not going to force them out of the cars. It's got to be attractive, and you'd like to build something near there. And it turns out that in many of these stops that we've envisioned in San Diego for our light rail, there's surface parking lots.
Mm-hmm. So it's a competitive grant,
right.
And so they look at applications from different jurisdictions, and they don't look at the land use. They just look at sort of the impact on adjacent.
And engineering, you know, is it feasible? And so our bill says— federal government, you need to ask part of a question. We would require a housing assessment and an evaluation of land uses around there. But particularly, what's your plan to build housing, both affordable and market rate housing, near this major investment that we're going to make? And that's a way to make sure that at least the competition considers what projects will be most effective.
Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that would generate projects with more ridership and like sort of transit-oriented neighborhoods
around the stops
instead of like park and ride sort of lots, right?
And it comes to at a time, and you've talked about this many times, where California is facing an acute housing shortage. Mm-hmm. San Diego is certainly in that same boat. And so wouldn't it have been great if the federal government had said to San Diego 10 years ago, you know what, we like your project. We'd like you to see you upzone all these various areas along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And that would make your grant more competitive. So that's basically the thing, the kind of conversation I'm trying to encourage for future projects like this.
So you were on city council in San Diego. I mean, why wasn't that sort of part of the calculus just in city politics as you were looking at this investment?
Boy, Matthew, the politics were so much different 10 or 15 years ago. I practiced environmental law for a while, and I got into local government for a couple of reasons. One is we had a massive number of sewer spills. The city council had just not invested in upgrading the sewer system. And as an environmental lawyer, I thought I could help. You know, we like to surf. We like to host tourists. You know, polluted beaches are just not good for us.
Sure.
But the other thing is that, you know, we were about to undergo a massive downtown redevelopment based around a ballpark, which I thought was a really important project to draw more density downtown, which is sort of, you know, the smart growth ideal. And it was pretty controversial. And I thought they were going to fumble the ball, mixed metaphor. I thought they were going to drop the ball and not do it. So I got involved in it and just sort of started carried on into politics. And then also some infrastructure projects we had to finish. But, you know, the environmentalists were not for growth in downtown. At the same time, we had a sort of a large lot zoning ordinance that would have effectively imposed an urban limit line like Portland. We would have said you can't upzone the rural areas. And the environmentalists were all for that, but they weren't for the other side of it, which was to build housing and this is an equity issue too, but to build housing in places where you already had surface parking lots and people might be able to walk and not use their car.
Right.
And
so you're saying if you want to constrain the sprawl of the city, you need to put things in where it's already
developed.
Right.
And then Portland started that in the 70s. But that certainly wasn't the politics in San Diego at the time. And now I think people understand the connection better. And we've got an ascendant YIMBY movement. So the opposite of not in my backyard, but yes in my backyard. Mm-hmm. So that the politics have changed quite a bit. But back then, if environmentalists came out to talk about a housing project, even an infill project, it was usually to oppose it.
Mm-hmm. So there's been a change. I mean, I think YIMBY sentiment seems stronger in San Diego than in most other cities I've seen. Do you have a theory of why that is?
Because we're great. I mean, I am so proud of the way it's taken off. I think that there's some good civic leadership. We have a group started as Move San Diego. I helped form when I got out of the city council. Now it's Circulate San Diego. It deals with walking and they've been very good at explaining this connection between the right kind of building and mobility. Mm-hmm. I think also people are tired of not being able to afford homes. And there's awareness among young people that there's some activism that could be applied toward that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just, for some reason, I think there's I think we have a club called YIMBY Dems, YIMBY Democrats,
mm-hmm.
Which I'm a founding member and dues-paying member. It'll let me know after this podcast if my dues are expired. But it's an exciting time in San Diego, and I think there's a lot of challenges ahead because making change in neighborhoods, I know, is very, very difficult. But now that we have a sort of a civic understanding that this is the right thing to do and a good thing for our future, I think the politics could be very constructive.
So you were saying making changes in neighborhoods is difficult,
that's
where it's maybe useful to have the federal government playing a role, kind of saying, hey, you got to make a change here.
Well, right, and to provide incentives. I think we know that if you have a surface parking lot, and I have experience with this. And you develop into a beautiful four-story building with, you know, apartments on the top and good retail, community-serving retail on the bottom. At the end of it, people like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can, as long as it's designed, you know, fairly attractively. But getting through it is just hell. I mean, I always say there's two attitudes towards change in San Diego. There's one group of people who are deeply skeptical, and the rest of them are absolutely opposed. Because, you know, you have this sense that taking this risk, I'd rather stay with mediocre than take the risk of something awful.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a hard thing to do that, but that's what sort of civic leadership's about. And it can't just come from downtown or Washington. It's got to come from the neighborhoods themselves.
Yeah, because, I mean, it is, you know, there's been a project going up across the street from me in Washington. It's a good project, you know, apartment buildings, there's an affordable element, there's some offices, there's some retail, but they've been building it now for a while, and it's like, it's noise, it's rats, like the street's closed, and
that's right.
I have like a new sympathy for a NIMBY sentiment. At the same time, I think the point of this legislation is like, if we're going to be building mass transit projects, like we should be doing something useful with those stations.
And we should have an expectation as taxpayers and as policymakers that we're going to get something for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, $1 billion ought to provide you a little bit of leverage. It's a lot of money. And so that sort of was my thinking, too. I think the good thing is that it's, you know, the planners love it. I think the planning community thinks this is a good thing. The taxpayer community thinks it's a good thing. My chief co-sponsor is Kathy McMorris Rogers, who I think is the third or fourth ranking Democrat or Republican in Congress. And so it's very bipartisan. I think we got a really good chance at getting this passed either on its own or as part of a larger transportation bill.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about next is what's the sort of coalition that you have here? I mean, what kind of groups have been supporting this? Because it's, you know, it's a little off the national political radar, but sometimes that's where progress can happen.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to be able to tell you that I'm going to solve the immigration battle during the Trump administration, but that's the kind of thing where, you know, you look for these things, these problems that you can chip away at. And the coalition, I think, is what I described. It's environmentalists and planners on one hand, and then it's taxpayers on the other hand.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had a really good response. When we tell people about this in bipartisan groups, they say, yeah, let me be a co-sponsor.
So how does New Starts, do you know about how much money is this? How sort of influential is it in transit projects nationally?
I think it is about $300 million a year. It's a lot of money for transportation.
Yeah. And this is the main federal mass transit program.
Right.
That happens
exactly.
Here, right?
So, so think about it, too. There's a difference between building transit in a place like Washington or Chicago or New York or Boston, which are pre-World War II cities that are already very densely packed, don't have side yard setbacks. Weren't built around the automobile, and then trying to fit it into a newer cities like Orlando or San Diego or Austin. And so the New Starts program is particularly important in directing those policy choices.
Right, because that's, I think, like the big sort of question for Sunbelt cities in the United States. And a lot of them, San Diego has built a light rail system. Phoenix has one now. Los Angeles has been making a very big investment in its metro. But East Coast cities, we sort of built trains and then the city grew around them. Whereas, you know, in the South and the West, you have cities that were built around cars and now, to an extent, are trying to sort of like retrofit them, right? And the question is like how much change can that drive and how much do people want to see change, right? And you're essentially asking here for more change to follow this money.
Right. So I always make the pitch that things are going to change. I think San Diego, we expect to grow from about 3.2 million to 4 million people in our county over the next, you know, 10 to 12 years. I said things are going to change.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do you want that change to look like? Do you want it to be continued people driving out an hour away because that's what all they can afford and clogging up your highways and your air? Or do you want it to be like, let's see if we can fit some of these people in here? And the idea, the challenge, Matthew, is to make sure people don't see this as something that they have to accept as a compromise. I mean, to be able to say, we can invest in your neighborhood and make it better.
Mm-hmm.
We had a planning commissioner really wanted this thing to be approved. The neighbors were all mad. And she said something like, you're just going to have to swallow some of this. Now, that is not exactly the pitch you want to make to people to get them to say, listen, how can we encourage investments in our neighborhood that will create more housing, more walkability, make it more interesting, make it more fun to live?
That's not how you that to Congress.
No.
Telling people.
You're going to just.
Sorry, you got to swallow it.
Yeah. She's an appointed person, not elected.
Right. That's the nuance of politics. Okay. Yeah. Let's take a quick break here, and then I want to ask you about some of the larger California context.
Great.
Support for this podcast comes from Planned Parenthood. Your body is your own. That's why Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Today, lawmakers who oppose abortion are challenging Planned Parenthood. Affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. Planned Parenthood believes that health care is a basic human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies. They also work tirelessly to oppose the onslaught of new policies aimed at interfering with personal decisions best left to patients and their doctors. They won't give up and they won't back down. You can join Planned Parenthood in the fight to help make sure that the next generation can decide their own futures. The organization needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, they can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future to learn more and support their cause. Support for this podcast comes from Planned Parenthood. Your body is your own. That's why Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Today, lawmakers who oppose abortion are challenging Planned Parenthood. Affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. Planned Parenthood believes that health care is a basic human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies. They also work tirelessly to oppose the onslaught of new policies aimed at interfering with personal decisions best left to patients and their doctors. They won't give up and they won't back down. You can join Planned Parenthood in the fight to help make sure that the next generation can decide their own futures. The organization needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, they can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future to learn more and support their cause.
The backdrop to this, obviously, is that the housing situation in a number of places in the United States, but I think California very famously, has gotten quite dire. And I wonder, you can think, how does this play into that? Like, what's your sort of bigger thoughts on housing in California?
A lot of us who work on policy issues in California are trying to figure out what we can do to get more housing. I think it's pretty well understood that housing availability and affordability is the biggest obstacle to the continued prosperity of our state, which has been booming. It's the fifth largest economy, I think, now, and it's generated a lot of terrific change and ideas and wealth. But if we can't afford to live there, this will not continue.
And this is a kind of paradox of success, right? I mean, California, it's nice, it's good weather, you've got a lot of big companies there. Right. So people want to move there, and it's becoming a problem.
And there are a lot of challenges, particularly to California. One is we have this Proposition 13, mm-hmm. which really encourages you to stay in your house as long as you can. Uh-huh. So if you're 65 years old and you and your wife are in the house that you raised your kids in, and you've owned it for a long time, your taxes are very low because it can only go up a little bit per mm-hmm. year. It's basically 1% with hardly any adjustments. And you might move to something much smaller and find your property tax go through the roof because the price of that is so much higher and it's assessed on the sale. So that really keeps people where they are.
So that discourages people who sort of don't need the space from reallocating, right?
Right.
So new families can't take over the existing housing.
And potentially from redeveloping properties into something more because, mm-hmm. you're sort of tax incentivized to stay. We also have a thing where the state gives localities 1% of sales taxes. Mm-hmm. So for a long time, and when I was in the city council again a decade and a half ago, the game was to try to get as much retail in your area as possible because the sales that happen in your city, you'd get to keep some of.
Okay.
That's totally changed now too because of the internet affecting retail so much. And, what we really ought to do is give cities more property tax revenue to incentivize investments that raise values like housing. We have zoning codes that are very defensive. It's not uncommon in California to have localities that have said if you want to raise density, you have to have a vote of the people. Mm-hmm. There's an effort in the state by Senator Wiener, I'm sure you're familiar with, SB 50,
yes,
to try to push back on some of the local zoning. That's probably a really constructive thing to do, mm-hmm, like to tell cities and counties, you know, hey, you have to allow some growth here and there. And we have to figure out how to deal with avoiding the fire areas.
Right.
So the urban wildlife interface is a place where, you know, in San Diego, we had major fires, lost, you know, we lost a lot of homes in 2003 and 2007. The worst one was the Paradise Fire. And, you know, you have to be careful about that. So there's a lot of challenges out there right now. And building housing near transit seems like one really right, easy solution.
So you're talking about putting development restrictions that are based on public safety concerns rather than sort of arbitrary.
Right.
You know, I don't want to see this happen near me.
Right? Yeah, my view of the tree.
Right.
And I think that's the thing we're gonna have to understand that along these areas where buses and trains ride, you know, we need to have 4-6-story buildings, and they can be beautiful and they can be really cool, but they're gonna have to be 4-6 stories.
Right, and you're presumably not gonna put the light rail line like right through the wildfire zone.
Right. Right. Yeah. So that's true. That's the current plan.
Right. So the idea is you take places where it's safe, where it's already not a natural environment,
right?
Right, and you say, okay, we're gonna have higher capacity transportation here. We're gonna have more people living here.
Right.
But not you're gonna have to swallow it.
Right. I mean, exactly.
So, I mean, but what do you do? You know, so I grew up in Manhattan. So
I love that lady, by the way. She's great.
No, I mean, I'm sure.
I just thought it was a bad moment.
It's the difference between, you know, a professional planner, I think, and a politician.
Yeah.
Is knowing what to say sometimes in that kind of thing. So I grew up in Manhattan. So, you know, I've never been frightened of tall buildings.
Right.
But, you know, obviously a lot of people, though, do have these kinds of concerns. And like, what do you say? I mean, trying to be more politic to somebody who, you know, really worries about the implications of apartment buildings coming into their school district, into their street, into their neighborhood.
I think you just have to fight it with facts. You know, I'll tell you another story, if I can, about a neighborhood that we redesigned,
yep,
in my district, Bird Rock. When I knocked on doors in La Jolla to try to become the city council member, I heard the same thing over and over again. And one neighborhood heard La Jolla Boulevard is a danger. The traffic comes through here too fast. And in fact, it was 6 lanes through a neighborhood where on either side, you couldn't find a house for less than, you know, $1.5 million, right? Beautiful, yep, neighborhood. But the restaurants all failed. The maintenance was down. They said, you're going to fix this thing. And I said, okay, let's fix it. So after I got elected, I held Bird Rock Week, and we had talks on transportation, on design, on financing, and we had about 50, 60 people come, and we came up with a sort of standard diagonal parking and traffic lights plan, announced it to the neighborhood, and all of a sudden, boom, it's people are so angry. And how dare you come up with this plan from downtown? And you know, in politics, you sort of get a sense for when something's really a big issue, and it's, you know, that this is something we really have to worry about. And my chief of staff said, you know, you have to go to the community and you have to let them vent. So I went to Bird Rock Elementary School, August 1st, 2001. 350 people all lined up at the microphone yelling at me how awful I was. And I'm thinking, you know, I gave up this legal career to do this stupid job. I'm not going to get pushed around. And so I said, okay, we're not going to do nothing, because that would have been the temptation. Just forget it. I said, you're going to decide what to do. And so we put a committee together each, and this is getting them involved. Each block, I put one person on. So we had about 20 people. And I hired them a walkability consultant named Dan Burden. I don't know if you know who he is, but he's like a hippie-looking guy. And he came in his sort of Caltrans fluorescence jacket, walked them around, did 2 design charrettes with them. I told them, don't do overpass or, you know, a tunnel, and we'll figure out how to do it. And they came up with 5 modern roundabouts.
Okay.
We had a 139-unit condo project that was going to come in to replace a hotel. And so they paid for a little bit of it. We had a smart growth grant, $5.6 million. A bunch of years later, a bunch of permits later, we had an award-winning redesign, walkability. The neighbors were so proud of what they had created. They assessed themselves to pay for the landscape. And you'd hear conversations in their table, you know, where one was talking to the other, and they'd say, oh, no, a modern roundabout conveys traffic much more efficiently than traveling. And they knew all this stuff. And so it was so cool. And the lesson was, there's 2 parts of it. One part of it is you have to educate and empower the community, mm-hmm, but also you have to say you're going to do something. Mm-hmm. So you need political leadership, but you need community partnership. And I think that's the way you do it. And I think the way you what happens now is people say, why can't we do Bird Rock in my neighborhood?
Mm-hmm. And the key to that, though, was getting people to see that you were going to do something.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
And so then once they started thinking about—
Then they think, I better be in the room.
Right. And you think about the options, right? Right. There's trade-offs, uh-huh. right? And I mean, I think in the housing context, right, it's that, well, people aren't going to vanish if we don't build housing
Correct.
For
yeah.
them, right?
Yeah.
It's got to go someplace. And if we have sprawl—
I think people don't—I still think people don't see that trade-off,
yeah.
that they think that it's okay if people drive 2 hours,
right.
unfortunately. They think that my neighborhood will be worse off with more stuff in it. And
right.
that's the battle that you have. Because you lived in New York, you mm-hmm. know how great New York can be. Now, the challenge for us in San Diego is my daughter lives in New York now. And mm-hmm. the thing she complains about all the time is she can't get to nature.
Sure.
You know, so she you know, we have to preserve that in San Diego.
Yeah.
So we still have to have our you know, we have great open spaces. I think we have a park system that's geographically one of the largest in the country. There's no reason we have to develop that.
Right.
When we can develop along these corridors that have transportation, maybe we can reduce the requirements for parking. We just remove the requirement for minimum parking. I think Portland does maximum parking.
Yes.
And I think we're definitely not there yet. But but a transition away from the car that's very conscious and planned can make for a much better town.
Well, and also this is, I mean, part of what people like about West Coast cities, as you say, is that you can be close to nature. Even kind of in the city.
Right.
But that does mean, you know, if you want to preserve that, then you can't have the development sort of going out and out
right.
and out.
Can't be
forever.
One-story building forever. It's
right.
true.
Right. And so then houses have to go someplace.
Right.
Right. And so you're saying put them downtown. All right, let's take a second break. I want to ask more about Congress.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity. But giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's SYLVAN29.com.
Last week, Kanye West accused one of the biggest Twitch streamers of being an industry plant. It's an idea that comes up so often on platforms like TikTok and elsewhere.
You see people who have blown up seemingly overnight, and the question is, who's behind them, right? That's what everyone wants to know. Tipping the scales and pulling the lever to make them seemingly the next it thing on the internet.
This week on Power User, is it even possible to create an industry plant on the internet? And if so, how?
So you got some bipartisan co-sponsors on this bill. Something I've found is that I feel like the environmental community is still sometimes of two minds about housing development. You spoke about that years ago, but I feel like oftentimes I've seen local environmental groups opposing rezoning and density type plans. And is that your experience on the national level at all?
I think at the national level, you're really removed from the community to community stuff to the detriment, I think, sometimes of, you know, I think it takes away from our effectiveness. Because if you don't understand what happens when the gears mesh at a local level, you know, you're going to miss the point, miss some of the nuance. So I don't see it as much as at the national level, but whenever I read about what's happening in Berkeley or what's happening in, you know, in D.C. or some development or what's happening in Raleigh-Durham, I know that battle. I know those words. I know that people are saying things like, I'm not against development. This is just the wrong place for it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm not against affordable housing. You know, this is just the wrong place for it. And that's the kind of battle that people fight all over the country still.
Right. But so in Congress, though, I mean, do you feel sort of environmental groups are going to want to go for something like this legislation?
Oh, yeah, I do. I think that this makes total sense for all the environmental groups. My issue with the environmental groups here is that we have to develop more bipartisanship around, particularly around climate action. Mm-hmm. There's a notion that we can do this as one party. And if we really view this as a, you know, winning the next world war or sending someone to the moon, that kind of effort requires national unity. And I think we're slow on finding that. That's what I would ask of the environmental groups.
Right. Well, I mean, it's hard.
No, it's hard, right? Yeah. I say bipartisanship is my lane and there's no traffic in my lane.
But so this has at least some appeal to Republicans because it's on one level a deregulatory measure, right?
It's a taxpayer accountability thing too. You know, okay. I think, you know, it says we're going to invest a gazillion dollars in your neighborhood. We want you to assure us it's going to perform. Mm-hmm.
Except to get, you would need conservatives to still want to spend some money on mass transit projects, right?
I think you're saying given that we're going to spend this money, it's a taxpayer accountability. Yes,
right.
that's a fair point. Because I would say there's not always a lot of support among the Republican Party for transit as there is among Democrats.
Right. I mean, that's the challenge, right? I mean, I think it's, yes, if you accept the premise that there's going to be money spent on this, then it makes a lot of sense to say, well, we should spend it on good projects rather than bad ones.
Right.
But I think the Trump administration just came out with a proposal that basically just scrapped federal transit funding.
Yeah. Their politics are awful. They try to zero out science research and all that stuff. And I would be concerned about that. I would also predict that I would bet on the status quo.
Yes. You know, in terms of trying to seek bipartisanship, though, I mean, how do you do that? I mean, what level of interest do you see from Republicans in anything related to climate?
Climate. There's a lot of openings now, I think. Hmm. Actually, you know, it's a really good question. I just talked to the Select Committee on Climate yesterday about this. So a few things. One, I'm on the Energy and Commerce Committee, and the EPA Administrator Wheeler came in and was asked about climate change. And he says, yes, I think the climate's changing. And yes, it has to do a lot with human activity, including the burning of fossil fuels. That's the same answer Gina McCarthy would have given from the Obama administration. And it's not the same answer that Scott Pruitt gave. Now, not that their policies are exactly reflecting a response to that.
Okay.
That's something.
That's like baby steps.
My colleague from West Virginia, Dave McKinley, when we were talking about trying to get back into the Paris Agreement, gave this compassionate speech about India and China having to do their part. But he says, if they don't do their part, you know, we're still going to have wildfires and droughts and Miami's still going to flood. So he was acknowledging kind of that, you know, maybe coal was having an impact like that. In Florida, the Republicans have seen that the streets are wet on sunny days, and mm-hmm. they know they can't ignore it. So you see that from Governor Senator Scott Rick DeSantis, my former colleague. They're even talking about climate responses. Matt Gaetz, who's probably the biggest Trumper around, he's the co-author along with Francis Rooney, Brian Mast of legitimate climate legislation. So there's some movement there. And I think you can't overlook what's happening in the religious side. So the Pope has made this a big deal, obviously. But there's something called the Evangelical Environmental Network, which is, you know, these are people that I can't talk to about a woman's right to choose or, mm-hmm. you know, marriage equality. That's just not, we're not going to agree on that. But we can have a conversation about saving God's creation and a real scientific one, too. So I think there's a lot of openings that we have to recognize. And I think we should run for that unity and get what we can. If I was in Sacramento, California, mm-hmm. and 2/3 Democrats, I'd do all sorts of stuff like they do there. You know, like, you know, we've got a low carbon fuel standard, which is an example for the country. We've got a requirement that the utilities go net zero by 2045. I can't get that passed here.
Sure.
So I want to think now about what I can do to get progress, to get more people involved in the effort so we can get carbon pricing. And there's bipartisan carbon pricing proposals. So. Mm-hmm. I think there's openings that we should not ignore. I'm not saying that it's going to be easy or that it's going to be like working in California, but I think there's room for progress.
So does that mean turning away from the sort of like Green New Deal type rhetoric and just focusing on these kind of smaller things? Is that
I think so. The thing about the Green New Deal is I probably agree with everything in there about climate. They've added things like a federal jobs guarantee and free college. And we could talk about that separately, but what we should not do is burden the already almost impossible task of saving the planet from incineration with more of these restructuring the economy goals. I think it just makes the task harder. And that's what Greta Thunberg said, by the way, the activist, the Swedish activist. She says, mm-hmm. you know, like, this is not about green jobs. This is about saving the planet. And the green jobs will come and benefits will come from it, but let's keep our eye on the ball. And so I think that to the extent that we're arguing with ourselves about the Green New Deal, I mean, we should be thinking about how we make progress on decarbonizing electricity, transportation, industry, agriculture, buildings. And we can make a lot of progress without confronting the extra stuff that people want us to confront. Uh-huh.
And so do you think, so your bill is on housing, transit. Obviously, it's a relatively small piece of the overall national kind of housing pie. Do you see other areas for the federal government to get more involved in housing policy that you think could be potentially useful?
We do something called the low-income tax credit, which mm-hmm. I think is still really important. And the idea of that is to, where the market's not generating housing that can be rent restricted.
Right.
We fill in the gap, essentially.
Sure.
And the value of that was on the natural harmed when the Republicans cut tax rates, because you don't get as much of a benefit
right.
off of a deduction. So there's efforts to try to bolster that. I mm-hmm. think that would be useful.
Right. So this is the low-income housing
right.
tax credit.
Right.
Basically, what happened was they cut the corporate tax rate. Right.
And the individual rate.
In the individual right. tax rate. Right. And so that means that claiming that credit is not as useful
right.
to investors as it used to be.
Doesn't make you as much money.
Right. So it's led to a sort of a—and this is for, subsidized projects.
Right.
Right?
Right. Right.
And so now we're getting fewer yeah. of those.
The other thing, the other role for the federal government is with respect to disasters. So mm-hmm. we spend all this money off budget. One of the first votes I took when I was elected, I took office in 2013, was the Superstorm Sandy response. I think we spent $60 billion off budget. Mark Meadows, who's the head of the Tea Party, and I have a bill called the Disaster Act, which would require us to do budgeting around disasters, to even look at how much money we're spending. Now, I know this is climate-related stuff.
Sure.
Mark Meadows doesn't have to admit that. He could just say, we got to get all of this disaster money. But one of the things we have to think about is what do we want to incentivize with respect to fire and flood risks?
Mm-hmm.
Do we want to keep paying for people to rebuild in flood zones? And do we want to keep paying 100%? Maybe what we should do is provide incentives through reducing those subsidies to local governments not to build in flood zones mm-hmm. and in fire risk areas. I think the federal government can have a role there, using the power of our disaster purse mm-hmm. to encourage good behavior locally.
To encourage people to sort of change where the housing is built.
And comply with better building codes, mm-hmm. and so to be more resilient. I think that we should be pushing better resiliency among local governments.
Do you think you could also, could you sneak some zoning type stuff in through that?
Yeah, I mean, I would.
Venue, like if your city gets so flattened by a hurricane, you got to build it back at mid-rises. And
yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing I think that's the kind of thing we should be talking about with respect to disaster relief. Like what happens next time? This is not going to get better.
Right.
This is going to get worse. I know fires in California are one of the big climate risks that we face. And, it would be idiotic for us to continue to push our luck and build into those areas without better building codes and without a better understanding of where the fire risk is.
So you're talking to an extent here. I mean, I think this is a tough call for some people, but to an extent, admitting that we are not going to fully get a handle on the climate change problem, right, and are going to have to make policy for a world in which this disaster severity keeps increasing.
Yeah, I do think that if we stopped emitting carbon today, there's still a lot of climate effects that are baked in. Carbon dioxide lasts mm-hmm. a long time. So I think we understand that sea level rise is something we have to plan for. But, obviously we better get our act together. I'm very optimistic, by the way. I'm by nature optimistic. I live in San Diego, California. I get on a plane to go to Washington, D.C. every week to do work, with the hope that I will, solve these problems.
How optimistic are you?
San Diego is a very nice place to live. If I was not optimistic, I don't think I would leave. I'm determined. I think this is the challenge of our time. I feel that we are spending a lot of energy fighting, and I think we should be spending more time listening. I don't think it's helped by the atmosphere created around the current impeachment areas, but our job is to compartmentalize and to see where we can agree on things.
And okay, fair enough. But before
I'm serious, Matthew. This is so novel, but I guess
it's sweet. I can hear the Twitter people yelling
at
you.
Give me a break. Yeah,
right. It's gonna be quite the thing. But before I let you go, I like to ask people. You know, it's what do you wish I had asked you? What should we have gotten to here on this subject?
I'd love to boast about my hometown more. I think you should. If you're lived in Manhattan, you should visit San Diego. I think it's a fantastic place. I'm really proud of what's coming out of there. And the thing about it is the innovative characteristics of California. I would like to see more of them in Washington.
All right.
Just more of an openness and more of a positive view of the future. And I'll try to keep bringing that to Washington to the extent I can.
All right. Representative Scott Peters, thank you. Thank you very much. And thanks, as always, to our sponsors here. Thanks to Malachi Brodus for engineering here, Jackson Bierfeld, our producer, and The Weeds will be back on Tuesday.